And now, for our third speaker, we keep moving right on up north and go out of the limits of the United States into Canada. It's a real privilege to bring you Tom.
I've been told if you want to get sober, don't drink. And if you want to stay sober, don't take the first drink. And if you want to get cured, drop dead. My name is Tom, and I'm an alcoholic. And I come from Winnipeg, Canada. And I'm very happy and very grateful to be here. And I'm amazed at the number of people that are staying here at this time of the night. I guess it just shows that this recovery process takes longer than some of us are willing to admit. Because I can't think of a sane reason for sitting around here at this time of the night listening to me yak about anything, even Alcoholics Anonymous or even the AA program. I was asked to talk about my story, and so I'm going to do that a little bit. I spent a lot of time in service work, so there we don't talk too much about our own stories. We have other things to talk about. But I'm the kind of an alcoholic who doesn't have any great esoteric story to tell. Nothing very exciting or different happened to me. I simply got drunk and got sick and got in trouble, and that kept on repeating itself until eventually I couldn't do it anymore. I didn't start out terribly young. I'm sort of Mr. Average Guy, you know. I couldn't get into those meetings that Tom was talking about earlier tonight, where you start out, I had my first drink at 10 and the next guy has it at 9 and so on. I've been at some of them, but I didn't qualify unless I was number one on the list, you know. Because everything that happened to me was sort of normal. And the thing that you might expect, you know. I left home very, very young. I did that kind of young. I got pitched out at 14 by circumstances only. And I've sort of been on my own ever since that time. I didn't get around to drinking till I was about 17. By that time, because I had some athletic ability, I'd gone down to California to play hockey. That sounds kind of silly, doesn't it? But it's the truth. And I was playing for a university down there. And we had sponsors even in those days. I've had sponsors all of my life, and I'm most grateful for that. This guy was Jewish. It was a Catholic university, so, you know, it was sort of ecumenical even in those days. And he invited me out to his house one evening. He was a wonderful fellow. He was an artist. He was the head piano player at MGM Studios, and worked out beautifully because I got some work during the summertime when many students didn't. This evening he invited me over, and I went, not realizing there was to be a party there this evening. Many of the people there were very well known because their faces were seen on the screen all of the time. And of course, I'm a little 17-year-old kid from Manitoba, Canada, and I had never been anywhere and I had never seen anything. And I was very shy and timid and fearful and concerned. I wanted to do well. I wanted to make a good impression. I wanted to be received. And I didn't think I would be able to make it, you know. And I sort of stood back behind a potted palm watching these people and absolutely awe-stricken by them. There was a director there who captured my attention by his tremendous confidence and his ability to deal with all of these people. And I couldn't imagine myself, for instance, walking up to talk to this man. Even though I recognized his name immediately, it was given to me because it was seen on the living screen all of the time, you see. And then a fellow came around who had dark trousers with a stripe down the side and a nice little white coat, and he had the most interesting tray in his hand, and he passed these goodies around. Everyone took them. I had no earthly idea what it was, but I took one as well, and I drank it like I've drank everything else in my life, at least ever since. I don't know about before. But I simply knocked it down. And then something happened, you know. There was a fire, a warm, warm glow. And I felt better, and I felt tremendously confident. I looked at this little pipsqueak of a director, and I walked over to him, and we became immediately engaged in a conversation during the course of the next 5 minutes or so, in which I managed to point out some of the inadequacies in his directing of films that could, some of the techniques that he could improve, you know. And I wound up the evening by knocking back quite a number more of these things and disgraced myself by getting sick and getting in a fight with one of the guests and being escorted back to the university. And every time I drank after that was like that. It was, I don't know anything. I hear these people come into Alcoholics Anonymous and talk about having 6 or 7 or 10 or 15 or 20 years of fun drinking. And I don't know what that is. I didn't have that kind of experience. There was one, this little gal that spoke last night, Marion Chapman, reminded me of something. You know, I never regarded myself as being the kind of person who landed in institutions or anything like that. I didn't have that kind of an experience. But she mentioned Lincoln Heights Jail, and by God, I made that. I was 18, and we had just won the California League Championship, and we went to a beautiful nightclub, real high-class place in Los Angeles called Chez Paris, and they spelled it P-A-R-E-E, just so you would be sure to pronounce it correctly. And I remember leaning over the trunk of someone's automobile and upchucking onto the tarmac, and some nice L.A. policeman tapped me on the shoulder, and the next thing I knew, I was in the tank with all sorts of strange people, and there was a bucket in the corner, and I was never so outraged in my life. I was beating on the bars. Eventually in the morning, the boys, the other guys on the hockey team arrived and got me out of that place. And I thought it was an unfortunate incident, you know, that would never happen to me again, and nobody would ever treat me in that way again. It was just that they didn't understand me, and it was all a horrible mistake. And I would make sure that nothing like that happened again. One other thing that I would like to mention that did happen to me in California that has always struck me as being a very odd thing. I was going in for breakfast one morning, and Father Johnson was in charge of the refectory, and he stopped me at the door, and I don't now recall how on earth we became engaged in this conversation, but this was in 1939, and he said to me, "You know, Tom, there is an organization which has started back in New York City, a promoter or a lawyer or something back there, and a doctor. And I don't really know what they call this thing, but it's for getting drunk sober. For drunkards, you know." And I felt guilty, and I had a stab immediately because I'd just gotten into a fight about 3 nights before, and I was on my way out. They were throwing me out of the university, not because I couldn't play hockey, but because I was an undesirable student. You know, this keen alcoholic mind just kills me because, you know, if you or you or you were going to pick a fight with somebody in the university, you wouldn't pick the star quarterback on the football team like I did. You see, you just don't do that sort of thing. But I did. So out I went. I got back to Canada in time to join the Royal Canadian Air Force so that the war wouldn't last too long. We'd get it over with in a hurry. But it lasted a while, and I spent the next 5 years there. But because of the discipline, that is to say, the discipline applied to my life, I wasn't in an ordinary station. I was always in an isolated place, and frequently we couldn't get alcohol of any kind, so my drinking was minimal. It was limited to those occasions when I got out on leave, and then it was disastrous, you know. And I was always getting picked up by those damn cops who didn't understand that I had just had a horrible accident. I had suddenly been taken drunk. And then they would turn me over to the service police, and I can remember waking up on an operating table and seeing two hands working on my eye and looking up into one of those lights that you only see over an operating table and vaguely wondering what happened, how did I get here, and feeling pressure on my face. And I've got scars all over my face. I don't know what the hell I did, but I always woke up with a big cut and black eyes, and, you know, this is not recommended as a way to improve your social standing, I can tell you that. So eventually, getting out of the Air Force and getting back to Winnipeg, well, that was a process. It took 5 days, and I sent a telegram each day to my dearly beloved wife, assuring her that I was on my way home, you know. And arriving home, I got, again, someone made a decision for me, and I got pitched into law school. And there again, the discipline was such that my drinking for those 4 years was almost nothing, except the odd occasion where the year I wrote my first year law exams, and I graduated, or at least passed, with honors, and I felt so terribly good about this, and I thought, my God, I'm really going to get along well here, and everything is going to be fine. And on my way home from a reception that the boys had given, I was again picked up by the police. This time, they had me charged with breaking and entering. And, you know, here's a graduate first-year law student picked up with and to be charged with breaking and entering to a store that had absolutely nothing in it. It was a vacant store. What the hell was I doing there? I had no idea. Absolutely none. After graduating, of course, things were different. There was a little bit more money. There was a little bit more time. There was a little bit less discipline. And I became engaged in politics. I got into the politics of the church, and I got into the politics of the hockey associations, and I got into the politics of a couple of clubs, and of course politics itself. I was always argumentative. I had always the ability to organize things, and I wanted to organize. The only organization I ever did led to nothing because I would always get drunk and, you know, blow the whole deal. Before, I was a good starter. I wasn't very good at the follow-through, and I was an absolutely lousy finisher. Nothing ever arrived at anything. I put on a tremendously confident air. All my clients thought I was a very, very confident lawyer. They liked to be represented by me in court. But I was the most unconfident person you ever met in all of your life. I had absolutely no confidence whatsoever. Not in myself or in the business or my clients or my wife or my kids or my family or anything. I didn't trust anybody. I couldn't trust anybody. So I got deeply immersed in religion. I thought this would be the answer, you know. And I knew all the rituals and all the rites and all the prayers, and I had 18 rosaries, and this one was blessed by somebody, and that was blessed by somebody else, and I had them by the Pope, and God knows who. And I spent hours with these blasted things, you know, like my friend here was saying a little while ago about praying. I prayed more than anybody, and I prayed in three languages. I could pray in French and English and Latin, and I very often had them going all at the same time, you know. And I got into the retreat house thing, and I made retreats, and then about this time the hospital thing started, because I don't give a damn how good an athlete you are or how tremendous a physical body the good Lord has given to you. There comes a time when this is going to start breaking down, and that's what started happening to me. Not so much physically, but there was a kind of a mental cleavage came about that made it difficult for me to recognize reality as the rest of the people saw it and reality as I saw it, you know? But because I was the solicitor for the hospital, I got a little better, a little different treatment than the rest of the people. I had a private room there, and they would take me up and throw me in the private room. By the strange coincidence, it was on the same floor as the nut ward. That was 5C, and I was in 5A, where the private rooms are. But it was as much of a prison as any other prison I was ever in. The bed was soft, the sheets were white, the nurses were great, but I was not free to come and go. I didn't know why I was there. I was not permitted to have a phone. You know, all the things that go on and the treatments that you get and the, I know about the straps and the jackets and doing all those things. So it wasn't easy getting to be an alcoholic. I had no idea I was an alcoholic, of course. because nobody breathed that word around me. Problem drinker, my wife mentioned that to me a couple of times, and I said, yes, I was, and I was going to do something about it, but never did anything about it. I wanted to tell you that it is not easy to learn to be an alcoholic. There's more to it than just having trouble with booze. You know, I had trouble with booze from the beginning, and I had a hell of a lot of trouble until I built up some kind of tolerance, and then I could drink a little more. I thought I was improving. I thought I was getting better at the art of drinking, you see. I didn't know about tolerance. I was out at an Air Force training station when I was the early part of my Air Force training. And I tell you this story to indicate to you that you have to learn how to handle people if you're going to be an alcoholic. I later became an expert manipulator, able to con and manipulate people to my heart's delight. I learned from an alcoholic. I didn't know he was an alcoholic, never seen one. I was going on an exercise one morning, and as I was climbing up on the wing of the airplane, everything blacked out and down I went, and they hauled me up to the hospital with a temperature of God knows what. It was enough that they were concerned about me, and they didn't know what it was I had, and they didn't want to put me in a room where anybody else was who might get it. So they took a room that had an alcoholic in it, because it didn't matter a hell of a lot, you know. Anyway, they're stubborn enough that they're not going to get it anyway. And this guy was seeing butterflies and picking bugs off the walls the first couple of days and making strange gestures and babbling away, and I couldn't really understand him. But then he started getting better, and it was very interesting for me to watch this, because there was a little nurse who looked after us, of course, nursing sister, and we called her sister. This was a little blonde gal, and very nice, but very persistent. She wanted things when she wanted them, you know. But she was so damn happy. She was a real little Miss Goody Two-Shoes, you know. She'd come rolling in the morning, and she'd say, well, how are we this morning? Are we comfy? Did we have our BM? You know, and... And it was interesting to see this drunk react and the way he got around, you know, to put her in her place. He would make remarks to her, and he'd say, well, I don't know if you did, but I didn't, and, you know, things like that. And this particular morning she came in and she said, well, have we had our specimen? Is it ready? And he grumped at her, no, it wasn't, you know. So she said, well, I'm leaving, and I'll be back in a few moments. I'm just going to take some temperatures. By the time I get back, I want this specimen to be ready. And he didn't even answer her, you see, but the moment she walked out the door, I could see him looking at his side table, and there was a glass of orange juice on the side table, and he took it, and he drank about half, and then he took the little specimen bottle that was there and poured in maybe an inch or so and filled it up with water and put the cap on and put it over there. And the little gal came back, and still smiling and happy, and she did something for me, and she looked at him, and she said, oh, I see that our specimen is ready, and she went over and picked it up and held it up against the window light, and she said, my, we're a little cloudy this morning, aren't we? And he looked at it, and he said, well, let me see that. She handed it to him, and he looked at it, and he said, by God, you're right, better run her through again. That's what I mean when I say it's not just easy to get to be an alcoholic. There's certain things you have to learn to do. You don't get there by loving your fellow man. But I got past the point, you know, of where there was any humor at all, and it kind of settled into a routine where I would go to the hospital, and then I would go to the retreat house, and then I would, you know, get into trouble, and there would be the police involved, and then in between little periods of sobriety sandwiched in there, and then back to the retreat house again to get holy, you know. And this just went on and on, and to the point where I was getting drunk coming back from the hospital. And this really wasn't a sort of an effective process at all. I have no idea how long this thing might have gone along, but then trouble started in my office. The troops were rebelling. You know, my partners, they were noticing that I was missing for 3 or 4 days at a time, and there were no trials to substantiate this, and no meetings, no nothing. I just disappeared. And they didn't like that, particularly at the end of the month when they started adding up the fee columns and there wasn't anything in mind because we were on a sharing deal, you know. But thank God I got to the point where eventually something had to give. Dave was talking about his last drunk. He said he liked to remember it. And I like to remember mine. I have no idea, really, how long this lasted. I think it was about 3 weeks. Because I wasn't in very good condition. So I don't remember too clearly. But I had a little sister-in-law who lived in Amarillo, Texas. And if I got a favorite, it's her. And she had phones to say that she was going to be in Winnipeg on such a day. And would I need the airplane? And I said I would. It came the night to meet the airplane, and I went to the airport, and she didn't show up. Well, of course, when you're relieved of a responsibility like that, you're free. So I just went back downtown again to join my companions, and I came in for breakfast about 6:30 in the morning. My routine was to come in, change my shirt, have a shower, shave, and get shaved to get back to the office, you know. And as I was sitting there drinking a cup of coffee in the kitchen, with a friend of mine, these people didn't know my family, you know, they just came in and out with me. And I was sitting there spilling coffee on my white shirt. My little sister-in-law walked out of the bedroom, one of the bedrooms, and she said, "Oh, good morning." And I said, "What do you mean, good morning? Where did you come from?" She said, "I came from Amarillo." Oh, I said, "I can't understand that. I was at the airplane last night. I waited for an hour and you didn't show up." She said, "Tom, I've been here for 2 weeks. I kind of missed that airplane somewhere." I got to the office maybe 7 o'clock in the morning. And I don't know what happened, but I knew that I just couldn't stay there. I felt different. I felt kind of odd. I got out of there and I went to a friend of mine who ran a sort of a bootlegging establishment. Stayed there till the beer parlors opened. We didn't have bars, thank God, in those days in Winnipeg. We do now. And I spent the day in the beer parlor. At 6:30, they closed for an hour, so I couldn't stay there. I went across to a private club, and I sat there with some idea that a friend of mine might come in, a fellow by the name of Anderson, who was a doctor. A man whom I admired very much, and I thought maybe if I talked to this man, he could give me some kind of advice, or maybe an answer, or something that might help me a little bit. But he didn't show up. So I was sitting there drinking double scotches. I had maybe 7 or 8 of them sitting in front of me on the table. And this had happened many times before. And many times before I had been sicker, and many times before I had been more troubled. I've been broker, I've been everything. But on this particular night, as I sat there, I reached over and picked up a glass, but from the time the glass left the table till it got to my mouth, I knew I was filled with absolutely certain knowledge that this was my last drink. And I put it down. Now, I don't know what happened. I've tried to tell many people about this. They either wind up looking at me very strangely, or they pat me on the shoulder and they nod at me and they say, I know," and quickly turn around and walk away. And I, you know, these are people. I'm not talking about you. God love you. I don't have to tell you. So I can't really tell you, you know, that the room got lighter, or a voice was proclaiming things to me, or anything like that. All I know is that suddenly I felt tremendously light. And not in the head. And I got up and walked out of that room and went downstairs and got in my car and drove home. I was not drunk. As I walked in the house, my wife said to me, "Have you had any dinner?" And I said, "No, I have not." She said, "Would you like any?" I said, "No, I don't think so." And I went to bed and I slept for at least 7 hours, which was about 7 times as much sleep as I'd had for many, many months. I got to the office the next morning, which was a Saturday, and I didn't go to the office on Saturday, again at 7 o'clock. And I worked feverishly till maybe 11 o'clock. one of my partners came in, and I called him into the office, and I said, "Lou, I got something I want to tell you." He said, "What's that?" Well, I said, "You know, I wasn't here yesterday." He said, "No, I didn't notice." I said, "I know damn well you did. You know where I was?" He said, "No, I don't know." He looked kind of scared, you know? I said, "I was drinking. And I've been drinking every day for the last couple of weeks or so. But there's something I got to tell you. I'm all through. I'm not going to drink anymore." And he looked at me. He said, "What are you going to do?" I said, "I'm going to join Alcoholics Anonymous." And he looked at me. And I was expecting him to say something like, "Well, it's about goddamn well time." Or something, I don't know what. But he looked at me and tears came into his eyes. You know? I thought this was fantastic. This was a, you know, this guy's a colonel in the army. He's now a judge. He's a hell of a guy. And we think they don't love us. We think they don't care. You know? And they're concerned about us. They really are. That was a big lesson to me. I learned a lot from him that day. Not that day, but after I got sober and started thinking about it. I then got on the phone and phoned a guy who's here tonight. He's my sponsor. I had followed this guy around a golf course. I knew, you know, that he was sober. And I'd followed him around a golf course for a couple of hours, maybe 3 years before, but my pride and my whatever it is that we got in here, this cannonball that we carry around, wouldn't let me go and talk to him. But that morning I was able to phone him, and he said, "Well, I got 20 minutes to spare. I'll come down and see you." He showed up at 12:30. He left at 9:30. He spent 9 hours with me. He told me all about alcoholism. He told me all about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. He didn't talk about me. He talked about himself. And I was able to identify with him. He could tell me things that I didn't know other people would know. He told me how he felt. The things that Dave was talking about, this loneliness that alcoholics have and fear. I was afraid all of my life. I didn't think anybody else was like that. I didn't think they had those feelings. But he described them to me so accurately that I knew he wasn't lying to me. And I was able to trust him. And he said, "I'll take you to a meeting." And I went with him. I was absolutely flat when I got to AA. I had no personality. I had no nothing. I was cold. I was like my friend was saying here a little while ago, Marge. Thank you, dear. Marge was saying, I was dead. Didn't know it. All they had to do was, you know, turn the key and that was it. But getting to AA, that was something. I lived in that clubhouse for the first year. Every night of the week I was there. Because I was so afraid that if I walked out the door, I'd suddenly get drunk again. And I couldn't trust myself. I heard them talking about God, and I heard about all of those things. I didn't really pay much attention to them because they weren't important to me. What was important was the haven. That was what was important. But then after I started trying to do a little work on the steps, I ran into a little trouble with some of these things. But I've been the most fortunate guy in the world because I met the most wonderful people in this outfit. This thing we call Alcoholics Anonymous, whatever it is. I met a guy up in Duluth at a roundup. His name's Chuck. Comes from California. He was talking here last night. And we got talking about God, as you understand it. And as we were sitting there talking, it got dusk and the moon came up, shining over the lake. And he said to me, "Tom, look out the window. Tell me what you see." Well, I said, "I see the lake and I see the moon and the clouds and the stars are coming out." He said, "That's right." He said, "That's exactly what I see." But he said, "You know, I see something else." He said, "From where I sit, I see a path of light across the lake, the reflection of the moon." And he said, "I'm sure you see one." And I said, "Yes, I do. I see it very clearly." But he said, you don't see the same path I see. He said, "It's the same moon, same light, but it's not the same path." He said, "The only way you could see the same path of light across that lake would be if you were to climb inside of my head and look out the eye holes. And you can't do that. And that's God as you understand him. And that's God as I understand him." And I was so grateful for that. Because I was always trying to find somebody else's God. And I was always trying to appease somebody else and live up to somebody else's standards. And when I got in here, you showed me that I didn't have to do that. And I found that I was able to learn from others. I got 9 kids, you know. Didn't have 9 when I got here. Only had 7, but I got 9 now. And none of those kids, I was not around when any one of them got born. And my son, Neil, was dying, and I couldn't even get there, you see. Because I'm a drunk. An alcoholic. My daughter Judy taught me a lesson that I'll never forget. I'm very grateful for it. I'd been left home babysitting. I was maybe 2 years sober at this time. She was a busy gal, and I wanted to keep her busy because I wanted to do a little bit of reading. I had noticed on the front page of the newspaper a picture of the world. So I took the scissors and rapidly cut it out and cut it into 50 pieces, made a little jigsaw of it, and I gave it to her and I said, here, you've been studying geography at school, put this together. It'll keep you busy for a little while. Went back to my reading. I expected 20 minutes, maybe 30 minutes of quiet meditation with my book. Wasn't more than 4 or 5 minutes went by. And she said, Dad, I'm all through. I said, what do you mean you're all through? You couldn't be. Got to be a geographical genius to produce that sort of a result. She said, no, no. She said, I noticed that there was a picture of a man on the back of that puzzle you cut out for me. And she said, I turned all the pieces over. And she said, I found out that when I put the man together, the world came out okay. And that's what you taught me in Alcoholics Anonymous. Most difficult lesson I had to learn, I think, was acceptance. And it's not easy for anybody. But I have a little story that I like to tell about it, which was helpful to me. And maybe if there's somebody new here, it may be helpful to them. There was a famous English artist who had painted a picture, and I know everyone here is familiar with this picture. It depicts the master standing at a gate in a garden wall, with his hand raised in an attitude as though he were about to knock at the gate. And there's ivy growing over the wall. And a little door cut in the wall. After he had finished this painting, because he had done it on commission, he wanted to have the opinion of many of his friends about it. So he called in all these artists and said to them, here is my painting. What do you think of it? And of course, they were highly complimentary, because it was a beautiful, beautiful painting. And they commented on the brushwork, and they commented on the composition and the lighting and the colors and everything. But one of the artists who was at the reception came up to him and said, that's a fine painting. He said, you know, there's something missing. There's something wrong with it. I'd like you to explain it. The artist said, fine, I'd be glad to. What is it? Well, he said, I've looked at it, and you have the master standing in front of the door, which is in the garden wall, and he's about to knock, and I can see the hinges on the door, but he said, there's no latch. And the artist just looked at him and smiled. He said, well, maybe you don't quite understand the painting. He said, you see, this is the door to the human heart, and it opens from the inside. And this you taught me, and for that I'm very grateful. Now, we're over our time, and you've all been very patient, and you're wonderful, wonderful people. And like every other speaker since this whole thing has started, I want to tell you, I love you. Thank you.
Tom. It's just a beautiful message. We are not over our time, Tom. We still have a few minutes left. I just want to say this. I want to particularly thank Gore Louise and the committee for inviting me to participate in this meeting. I want to thank the speakers again, Dave and Marge and Tom. I'm going to tell you how wonderful it's been for me to be here this week, although I've been ill, and to get to see some of my old friends. This is my third international that I've attended. And I don't know when one has ever meant more to me than this, because I will just say this one thing. I was a hopeless, beat-down drunk a little over 22 years ago. And day by day now, which is over 8,000 days, working it this way and being active in Alcoholics Anonymous, the fringe benefits that have come my way have been wonderful. You'd have to know my story. But I had a dad, a retired farmer, that died of a broken heart in 1947. He was my crutch. And here, this week, I have a daughter that's attended this entire convention with me, who has found this way of life because I was able to release her, and release her with love, which my Hanan friends told me. And it's meant so much to me just to be around with her and to know that this way of life is for young people as well as older people like myself. And it is truly a day-by-day program. Because as I sat in my first meeting that night in Phoenix, I had a loneliness that you heard spoke about here tonight that only one alcoholic knows. And we all know it as practicing alcoholics. But in here, it seems like it kind of leads us. And that night of my first meeting, I heard a man that had a year's sobriety read from our big book something that I've never left a podium without saying. And he said to me that night, and I thought he was just talking to me. Of course, I later was to find out it came from our founder, Bill, and it came from God as he understood him. I thought only there were words for me. He said that night to me, and if you are lonely tonight or happen to be new, maybe he's talking to you when he says, abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit. And you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. And he ends it up by saying, may God bless you and keep you until then. And now, after a moment of meditation, I would like to ask, and for those who wish to join us, I'd like to ask Maxine over there if she'll lead us in the Lord's Prayer.
Lord in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil.